til Personvernpodden, en podcast av Datatilsynet.
Han har terget på seg store selskap og stolte nasjoner. Han er en internasjonal autoritet på personvern og kunstig intelligens, og han mener at personvern ikke kan være en privatsak. For om du gir blanke i personvernet ditt, har det konsekvenser for folk rundt deg. Gjest i denne episoden av Personvernpodden er Mark Rothenberg. Jeg heter Kari Løymann. Jeg jobber i Datatilsynet som prosjektleder for vår rykende ferske regulatoriske sandkasse for ansvarlig kunstig intelligens. Der vi skal hjelpe virksomheter med å utvikle og bruke personvernvennlig kunstig intelligens. Vi er nå midt inne i utvelgelsen etter å ha fått inn våre 25 første og svært interessante søknader. Og første runde i sandkassa vil sette i gang i mars. Men nå varmer vi opp med å lære hva som skjer på KI-fronten der ute i den vide verden. Læreren er amerikaner og snakker til oss fra Washington, så denne episoden av Personvernpodden blir på engelsk. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So Mark is an accomplished chess player. He is also the author of several books. And Mark, you have also established several organizations within the field of technology and society, civil society engagement and privacy. And I know you as the founder and president of EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center in the US. And EPIC has achieved a lot of accomplishments, and part of that work is that you have pursued several successful consumer privacy complaints with the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, where you have taken up privacy issues with big companies such as Snapchat, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Google, amongst others. And also, your role has changed. You are now the director of the new Center on AI and Digital Policy at the Michael Dukakis Institute. My first question to you, Mark, is you are known for being very good at merchandise, privacy merchandise in EPIC. At these conferences, you have great presentations and so on, but you also bring stickers and buttons and coffee mugs and very nice bags with the EPIC logo. Will you continue this tradition in your new center, or is this the past now?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Carrie, for inviting me to speak with you today. And secondly, it's very nice to be thought of for my merchandise, because of course, in the privacy world, we tried for many years to make the topic interesting and engaging for the general public. We wanted people to be able to talk about privacy and think about privacy without having to read complicated academic articles and long books like, you know, most of the scholars like to do. So yes, I mean, we made t-shirts and coffee mugs, and we were always looking for good slogans. One of my favorite slogans was, if you can't protect it, don't collect it, which I think for you at a data protection agency actually makes a lot of sense. It's you know, almost our fundamental principle. And we've carried some of this over into the world of AI policy, because again, we want people to be able to talk about artificial intelligence in a way that doesn't require deep expertise. It's something that everybody should be able to understand. We launched a campaign a few years ago on algorithmic transparency. And our point, just in putting those two words together, was to get people to think about the need to open up these black boxes. So we have still, you know, phrases like open the code on laptop stickers, I think we used. And we'll continue to do that. Of course, it's more difficult today. We have less physical contact. There aren't the conferences that there used to be, but I promise you, we will get to work as soon as there's a new conference and produce good merchandise.
I'm glad to hear that, and I'm sure the listeners out there are happy to hear that as well. But these are complex issues that are difficult to understand. So I think, you know, making it a bit lighter with, yeah, good slogans and some entertaining merch is a very good idea. So can I ask you, Mark? The Center for AI and Digital Policy, I think you opened quite recently. What is the aim of this center, and what are you trying to achieve?
Well, I'm very excited about this new project. As you mentioned before, I've started many organizations over the years, and each one we try to engage at the moment what we think is most important. And with our new center, we are trying to promote AI policies that are fair, are just, are inclusive, that respect the best traditions of democratic societies. And I was very fortunate in launching this project to be able to do so with the former governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis, a very well known and well respected political leader in the United States, who himself had run for president a number of years ago. He's friends with President Biden. And he, on his own, had said a few years ago, we need an international accord on artificial intelligence. And so we've worked over the last couple of years in support of that. And I'm just very, you know, enthusiastic about the work that we have ahead.
That's great. So does that mean that the aim here is to represent or the democratic values and try to stimulate the inclusion of these in the development of AI and privacy in particular?
Yes, absolutely. I have a real concern. I've worked in this field for a long time, and of course in the US, you know, we have made some progress on privacy. There's more to be done. But AI, to me, seems to accelerate technology, social change, the economies. I mean, we see this now, of course, with COVID, which is also exacerbating many inequalities in our society. And so there is urgency to make sure that as countries deploy AI techniques, they do so in a way, you know, that's respectful of people and protects fundamental rights.
Yes, I agree. And I know that you've already launched a report regarding the AI and democratic values, where you look at different countries. And I think you look specifically at what kind of AI policies different countries have and whether they include democratic values or strategies in these policies. Could you say something about the main findings in the report?
This was a really interesting project, and you know, your listeners can find this, I think, online if they do a search for artificial intelligence and democratic values. That's the title of the report. We did something which no one had ever done before, which is that we compared and evaluated and assigned scores to national policies on AI. And a perfect score would have been a 12, for example, and a complete failing score would be a zero. Our range is between a 2.5 and a 10.5. I'm gonna keep the suspense and not tell you who ended up where. You'll have to go online to find the answers. But our goal in designing the survey and the scoring was actually to call attention to countries where we had real concerns because AI was used, for example, for facial recognition against political opponents and ethnic minorities, which is a practice we think should not occur. It's actually a red line, as many NGOs have proposed. And then, of course, you see other AI techniques that seem to be socially beneficial, and you see national AI policies that reflect a lot of public input and a lot of public discussion. And so we weighed those factors favorably, and we assigned all of our scores. And of course, some countries were annoyed with us, and some countries liked us more. But of course, we told everybody that we're going to do this on an annual basis. So there'll be new scores at the end of this year, and the standings will change.
So it's possible to improve your ranking.
It is always, you know, it is always possible to improve. But this type of oversight, we also believe, is very important in the field of AI policy, because, of course, there's a lot of talk. And, you know, understandably, politicians are describing new AI initiatives and the research benefits and the investments. And I don't think that's bad. Mm. But I think we also need an ability to evaluate these programs. I think we actually need to look at them independently and ask, for example, are there privacy safeguards? Is there some transparency? Do they respect human rights? And those are the questions we asked. We were very fortunate, by the way. I was able to find about 25 people around the world who worked on this project with me, and that team continues to grow. And we are planning this year actually to build a network of academic institutions who would like to learn more about evaluating AI policy.
Right. And I also saw that from the evaluation points that you have, that you look at, do they have a strategy? Does it include democratic values? But also that I think you had one point where you ask, do they actually implement them or put them into practice? So then I'm wondering, I also noticed that Norway was not on the list of countries. So maybe that's a point of improvement for next year. But for example, our sandbox, would that maybe count as a way of implementing the strategies into practice?
Yeah, so really good questions. First of all, apologies to Norway. But the way we started, because it was our first year and we didn't think we'd be able to cover all the countries, we took the top 25 countries by GDP, and we took another five countries that we thought were particularly interesting because of something they had done or were planning to do on AI policy. So that's how we created our initial list of 30, but our goal will be to score and more. And I think Norway will be, you know, in the next review.
That's good. Yeah, we like to compare ourselves with Sweden, and I saw they were on the list and they didn't do like particularly well, if I remember correctly. So that makes us even like more interested in joining the list.
I'm sensing a little bit of that rivalry there. I don't think that's a new thing, but thank you for that. We will pick up on that in the next report. But to your other point, which is also important, you know, we are looking at implementation. So it is one thing for a country to say that they support the OECD AI principles, which are very important. And of course, a lot of countries have said they support those principles. But we are also interested in whether, in fact, they're implementing the principles, which is actually much, much harder to evaluate. And we are still developing our methodology for that. We made some progress. You have to start somewhere. And I think this was a good start. You ask about the sandbox. Sandbox is a very interesting concept, you know. I mean, on the one hand, you want to create some space. I don't want to say that you have the regulators locked up in a closet, but a little bit more freedom than you might otherwise have if the regulations were directly applied. So, you know, honestly, I mean, we have some concerns about how that can best be made to work. I think one of the keys, of course, always in this field is to recognize that when there are consequences for actual people, there are certainly some responsibilities as to what you do with the data. So you can imagine lots and lots of scenarios where you have, for example, let's say synthetic data or data that's not personally identifiable. And in those instances, we say, well, you know, whatever people come up with that's innovative, that could actually be very useful. But then when we begin to take the personal data of actual people, you know, I think rightly there's going to be some question about the possible consequence. So that would be my general advice on a sandbox procedure. I can make one more point. I've actually written about this for, you know, Scientific American and others. I think there is a real benefit in the AI field of avoiding the collection of personal data, because I think some of the biggest challenges that countries face today, for example, concerning climate change or or land use or even productivity don't actually require personal data, generally speaking. And so the practical consequence of focusing AI applications on some of these big social issues and climate-related issues would actually be very productive, which is another way of saying we don't necessarily have to be talking about balancing or trade-offs. I'd love to see AI systems help solve some of the challenges that are facing the planet.
So the sandbox that we have here in Norway will actually not give an exemption from the regulation. We are trying to work within what is regulated and find good privacy solutions to AI systems. And some of the need that we have seen here in Norway is that we see companies maybe avoiding using personal data because they're unsure. There are maybe some gray areas on how to interpret the regulation and typical questions such as transparency, like how transparent do you actually need to be? And also, as you mentioned, data minimization, what is required and how can we do this in practice using as little data, but at the same time having good AI systems. So we hope to explore these gray areas or areas where there are questions on how to implement the regulation we have in Europe in practice. But I wanted to ask you, are there any like gray areas or areas that you would like to see kind of explored a little bit more in detail on how, and that could also be when it comes to fairness or how do we avoid discrimination or connected to democratic privacy related values. Do you see any areas that you would like to see maybe some clarifications or examples of how it could be done in a sandbox?
Well, of course, the key themes you oftentimes hear in AI policy are fairness, accuracy, and transparency. And if you're able to develop formal metrics that allow, you know, a regulator or a customer to be able to say, you know, this system is more accurate or more transparent than another, in some respects, that could actually help introduce market mechanisms that would lead toward competition and toward better products and services. So while I favor regulation, I do also respect the role of markets and competition. The challenge is to be able to create the metrics in which people can make meaningful decisions that drive the competition. And my concern today is that we just don't have the ability to do that. We have to accept the assurances of a company we might trust when it says, you know, this product for evaluating potential employees does a really good job. And you might ask the question, well, how do we know it does a really good job? And they say, because we're a good company and you know us. And to me, that's not adequate, particularly when technology is changing rapidly. I'd like more detail about how that determination is made. And I take the hiring example very purposefully, because one of the key points that researchers have uncovered is that many of these systems simply replicate bias. A company and organization that has always hired people that look a particular way or from a particular background, not surprisingly, when they automate that process, are going to find the exact same people score favorably for new jobs and promotion. And if we're thinking seriously about how to make the world more inclusive, then we will need to look at those techniques more critically and say, well, that's just giving me an answer, you know, from how we used to do things and we'd like to change. Mm-hmm. So I think we need better techniques, and maybe your sandbox can help make this possible, so that we actually have the ability to make, you know, good choices about AI services based on good information.
Mm. And do you see this market mechanism where privacy is maybe a competitive advantage as something that is coming soon, or are we still not quite there?
Yes. Well, I have a somewhat different view of privacy, which is to say, I think that simply has to be built into all systems. I don't particularly like the idea of people trading, you know, privacy for some other attribute. I think of privacy protection much like I think of auto safety. If a manufacturer says, you know, you'll save €1,000 on this car, but we've decided not to include brakes, and it's your choice, you know, I don't think people should be given that choice, because that's not a car that's safe either for the driver or, interestingly, safe for others if it's placed on the road. And sometimes with technology, we also miss this dimension. We say, well, let people decide if they want to use a service, you know, that doesn't have all the best features. But that may actually have consequences for others as well. An obvious example being email. I mean, if you use an insecure email service, everyone that you're in communication with is also at risk. So these things, in my view, need to be built in.
And when do you think we'll get there? Are we there now?
No, I don't think we're there now. And as I said at the beginning, I have a genuine concern. I try not to use the word worry, so I'll use the word concern. The temptation to rely on complex AI systems without being able to prove the outcome or to replicate the outcome, you know, is very great. It happens in a lot of different domains. I mean, we see it in the measurement of ad revenue for companies that, you know, place ads on the internet. We see it in the ability to match images of cats. And you look at the outcome and you say, wow, that's tremendous. That's better than what a person could do. But if you ask the developer, can you prove how you did that? The developer might, you know, toss their hands and say, well, this is machine learning. And you see, with machine learning, it's actually very difficult to prove outcomes. And that's a problem, I think. I actually have a bit of background in AI, but, you know, I was there in the very early days, and they were simply what we would call then rule-based expert systems. They were like giant decision trees, which were easy to understand and evaluate. Today, the systems that we look at are very difficult to comprehend.
That's true, the black box, the famous black box. Can I also ask you about the situation in the US? You have a new president now, and there's been discussion around a federal privacy bill for a long time. Do you see anything happening there in the near future, or are we still far away from a federal privacy bill?
Well, I'm optimistic. In fact, if you work in the privacy world, you have to be optimistic. You really don't have a choice, I think. There is a lot of activity at the state level, and it's significant, for example, that California recently updated its own state privacy law. That's, of course, a very influential state with a very big economy, and it tends to have sometimes people call the California effect, is like the Brussels effect. So we follow what happens in California and the other states. I think there's support in Washington for federal privacy legislation. There were many bills that were introduced last year. There is a risk, of course, in the U.S. system that you could, we would say preempt or overwrite the stronger state laws, because some people would say, well, let's have a simple national uniform standard. Now, of course, if that occurs at a high level, you know, I think consumer advocates would be pleased. But I think the worry is that it will occur at a low level, and the practical consequence will be to remove protections that states such as California recently established. So that's why we oftentimes use the phrase, we want to see a baseline federal law, a minimal standard, and leave the states the freedom to develop stronger laws, particularly as new challenges emerge. It's a rapidly changing field. And if we simply pass one law and new problems emerge and the states can't respond, that will be a problem.
Interesting to follow the development. Another topic that I know is close to your heart is the universal guidelines for AI. could you tell us what is this initiative and what's the next step?
Sure. So just to provide a little background, several years ago, I was working with the OECD, which you know is that Paris-based organization of many economies. Very good group, by the way. I mean, they do good policy work and they gather a lot of data, and I think they provide a lot of good information to national governments making decisions. And they specifically wanted to develop a policy framework for AI. And so I worked with them and other experts and member countries to develop that framework, which was adopted in 2019. But while we were doing that work, I also became aware that there were a lot of issues that the OECD was just not prepared to address. And I would say they fall generally under the category of red lines, which is, you know, really a willingness to prohibit certain types of AI applications. I mean, you have countries today, for example, that score citizens based on their political views. I think that's fundamentally wrong, and technology should not be used for that purpose. So we would consider that a red line. I have a similar view about facial recognition in public places. I mean, facial recognition is great to, you know, open your iPhone. It's a type of authentication. And as long as the individual maintains control of her image, that's perfectly fine. But when it's used to track people in public spaces, really without their awareness or any, you know, legal basis, that's very problematic. So that would be another red line. So what we did was to create a second framework that's intended to complement the OECD framework, which we call the Universal Guidelines for AI. And we had several hundred experts in law and technology endorse the framework. It's been widely circulated. Governments are interested. It's, you know, a bit more controversial. You know, governments like to balance interests, and they like to say, well, we'll do a little bit of this and a little bit of that. We actually said some of these things we don't think they should do at all. And our report, AI and Democratic Values, actually looks at whether countries are adopting some of the red lines we propose. And so we were actually very happy to see the Council of Europe on January 28th announce its support for a ban on facial recognition as a form of surveillance, which is the right way to understand the problem. We're also very glad to see the campaign of the European NGOs, I think it's called Reclaim Your Face, as a European citizen initiative, which will launch on February 17th. So these are good developments. They reflect political engagement around real challenges. They will force governments to make decisions, which we think is good. Yes, we'll see what happens. And that was a big part of the Universal Guidelines. That was our intent.
Mm. So facial recognition for surveillance is one red line. Are there other red lines that you think should be mentioned as important?
Yes, well, I did mention the scoring of citizens. One of the other areas which we're fascinated by is, we call it the, you know, when to pull the plug problem. And there is an issue with AI systems, not only that they tend to develop a degree of autonomy, but companies and developers have this view that suggests that maybe that's not even such a bad thing, that maybe it's okay that we have intelligent devices that continue to operate without human intervention. We simply disagree. We're not against, you know, you could call them smart devices, but we want to be sure that a person is always responsible for what the devices do. You get into, you know, interesting philosophical issues here. I mean, can a robot have freedom or its own agency? We think the answer is simply no. I mean, this is not an argument against innovation. There are some very smart devices. it is an argument for maintaining human control. So if you lose human control over an autonomous device, one of the other principles we set out in the Universal Guidelines is that you as the developer or the company that deployed that device actually have an affirmative responsibility to pull the plug. And if you think you are losing that ability, you should pull the plug sooner rather than later. This is like, you know, that famous movie 2001, where you know, the astronauts are trying to get back onto the spaceship, and Hal says, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that now." At the point that a robot is telling you that it doesn't want you to pull the plug, you've already lost control. So we want people always to maintain control.
That's very interesting. And in our sandbox, we also hope to draw some red lines. Where does the line go? But also kind of balancing that, trying to also show the possibilities that you have in actually using personal data within, you know, an ethical and legal framework. If you would see like a dream project for in the sandbox where we could show, you know, how you can use AI in a way that is beneficial for privacy, like what kind of project could that be?
Well, as a general matter, you know, my instinct is that anything that minimizes the collection and use of personal data is good. And the very famous computer scientist at UCLA, Judea Pearl, has published a book called The Book of Why, by the way, which is a big, you know, philosophical book about AI. But it's a very important book, and it's a very influential book. And one of the points I think Pearl is making is that we have bought into this more data is better view much too quickly. He says we really need to think seriously and formally. He's a mathematician, so I couldn't, you know, follow precisely the formal argument. But he actually, through the book, demonstrates in formal mechanism that this is a fallacy, and that much of what we can accomplish, we could likely accomplish more accurately, in fact, with less data, which is really intriguing. And I think this insight has enormous implications for how we think about AI research. So that would be one suggestion. Another suggestion you mentioned at the beginning, you know, I'm a chess player, and I've always been interested in computers and chess. And I wrote, you know, a zillion years ago programs to play chess and backgammon. So I understood that in the early days. And then of course you have this tremendous and surprising result just a couple of years ago in the chess world, where AlphaZero beat the strongest traditional chess program, which was called Stockfish. And people looked at those games and they were kind of fascinated. It was machine learning versus AI. And as Garry Kasparov wrote about the match, he said you find a level of creativity in the new AI that he did not anticipate. Which again was very exciting and very intriguing, and had no harmful consequence for privacy. No personal data was harmed during that match. So that's another good way to think about exciting projects in the AI field.
More with less data.
More with less. That will be on our next tote bag.
Yeah, that's a good slogan actually. Okay, well, thank you so much, Mark. It's very interesting to hear your thoughts and experiences, as always. And thank you for joining us in this podcast.
It was great speaking with you, and good luck on the new project. It sounds very exciting.